You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Let's Get Civical.
This is the podcast where we break down politics, government structure, and dive into the context of current events, but in a super fun way. I'm Lizzie Stewart, comedian, feminist, and political junkie.
And I'm Arden Walentowski, former Senate intern, campaign staffer, and political strategist.
In this episode, we're going to be talking about the presidential veto.
So grab your red marker.
And let's get civical.
Thanks, everybody, for joining us today. Our guest is Piper Perabo. She's an actor, activist.
She's joining us on Skype today.
We're going to talk about the presidential veto. But first, we're going to start with an issue that is near and dear to my heart and to Piper's. And we just did an episode on voter turnout. And so we're going to talk about the New York State voter reform legislation that passed this month. And we're going to talk about what passed, what it means, the great things about it.
Are we excited? Are we sad? Are we nervous? Because you feel like when like a bunch of things pass at once, I automatically get very anxious, you know, because there's a lot of words, there's a lot of subsections, and I don't know first glance what we're dealing with.
Yeah.
So it's very exciting.
It's very exciting.
Weed through it.
Luckily, all of the stuff in this package is good. It's all good stuff.
Yeah.
So I know this is like an issue that's super close to your heart. You've been very active with it. And so, you know, what's your initial reaction, your take?
I'm so excited it passed. And it passed so fast that I think it gives me real hope for the state legislature that we can really get things done. We have a true blue New York, like we can get some great stuff done. And then the governor signed it really quickly. And so now I'm just sort of holding my breath to make sure it's in the budget. I think the budget draft just due the last day in March.
Yeah.
And so I want to make, because some of these things cost money.
Totally.
And so if they're not funded in the budget, then it's all just hot air. So I don't want to like have the party to celebrate everything until I see it in the budget in March. And then, although when it all passed, I thought it was important to celebrate because I think as a Democrat, like, I think we need to celebrate more. I think we like all works. We're so earnest and hardworking and we don't go and have like, you know, like when you do stuff, like you can have a kegger or you can like, have a pizza party. Like that makes it fun to like get stuff done. But there are things that still have to happen. You know, we didn't get everything in this first go. So I think it's important to celebrate what we got and then like keep the pressure on.
Totally. I think that's 100% accurate. Yeah. Some of the things that were in the package were early voting. So this now opens the state up for early voting.
Which, like, it did not have early voting
at all
prior to this package, right?
No, it was just one day. It was the Tuesday that was it. That you, it was open from like 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. That was it. That you had like, what is that, 15 hours to go and vote. And if you had it, you know, whatever, you couldn't, there was no other way to vote unless you got an absentee ballot beforehand.
Yeah. And you have, before this package, you had to have a reason to get an absentee ballot. And the other, what I was waiting for when the legislation was put up in the early voting, what's important in early voting is that not only that you can vote early, but that you can vote, that there's some evening hours and that there's some weekend hours, because like they have to give you time off from your job. But say you have three jobs, say you're caring for an elderly parent, say you're caring for children. Those are jobs that, you know, caring for an elderly parent, they don't give you time off. So when I saw the evening hours and weekends, I thought like, okay, we're doing this for real.
Yeah.
This is
It felt very much like it wasn't a cursory passage of legislation. It's actual, because of the way they wrote it is like 10 days before the election, there has to be early voting. So you're automatically going to get some weekend days in there, which is pivotal in a state, especially, you know, in New York City, where people work random hours, they work odd jobs, they work, you know, different types of schedules. And so not everybody has the ability to take off a Tuesday
of all the days. Like that's my most busy day every year. It's like, I always have like a doctor's appointment. Everything is scheduled for that day. But did they establish how many early voting days would be allotted in this 10? So it was 10. Great.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Great.
And it has, and also it stipulates like the second day prior to the election. So that's a Sunday usually. Mm-hmm. So that makes sure that there's definitely you holding a weekend.
Yeah. The other thing that passed, which I can't believe we were still doing this in 2018, is the consolidation of federal and state primary days. Like, I was on a primary campaign and a congressional race this past cycle, and I was like, why are we doing this in June? This is crazy. Yeah. And then why is Cynthia running against Cuomo in September? This is nonsense.
Well, first of all, it costs more money, which everybody should get behind, like making this all cost. But let's be efficient with our tax dollars. But also, it's confusing.
Totally.
You know, if you work on a primary campaign, you're just pissed. But if you're a regular person, you're like, wait, why are we voting Cuomo Nixon today? And what about the other? It's so, and like, confusion is the easiest way to get people to stop.
Totally.
Yeah. Because
they sneak up on you. I feel like these primaries, I'm always like, oh, wait, I have to vote next week?
Yeah.
Holy moly. It's like I just got back, you know, from a summer vacation and now I have to decide the governor?
Yeah.
Well, and especially like,
I was going to say, especially when you're trying to send out information about candidates,
right.
Let's just do it all in one block.
Totally.
So we're not like, there's, you know, city council and then there's this and then there's governor. It's too much information. Yeah. People are like, oh, forget it. And
give me a pamphlet.
I know. Give me like a threefold divider thing.
That's sexy.
One of the thing I was joking with some friends of mine who also work in politics, and they were like, I said, we're just going to be in campaigns for like literally the next 10 years because we're going to have 2020 is starting. That's on. So like the next 2 years, that's already election time. And then you've got midterms and you've got city council races in between there where like the entire, basically 75% of the New York City Council will turn over because they'll be term limited out. So like the city, especially the city, not so much New York State because city council is obviously New York City, but there's so much that's going to happen election wise over the course of like the next 10 years that to consolidate these two primaries, it makes so much sense and will make participation in elections and the electoral process and teaching people about where to go just so much easier.
Yeah.
Right. Let's just simplify it so that we can raise voter turnout. So that's important.
And we're doing that. Closing the LLC loophole, super important.
This super important. And I think like when you say it, like it can sound like, I don't even know what that is.
I was just about to say, can we just quickly unpack that for a second?
So leave that on the table.
Yeah.
Like companies could create an LLC and then donate from all. So like the same company has multiple LLCs. Mm. So even if there's a limit for how much you can give, you can just create another LLC and give more and more and more. That's not fair.
That's really not fair.
It was a big loophole. And like, let's not do that. That's not fair.
So now it's like you can what? You can only do one LLC now or no LLCs?
You can do an LLC, but you have to say, from what I understand, there's a limit to how much an LLC can mm-hmm. give, and you have to disclose who is a member of that LLC so that that's part of their campaign donation, so that those people can't then like go to another right. LLC. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like they're trying to make it fair so the business will get a chance to
donate that. Pad pocket. Exactly. Yeah. Cause they track your donations by your name and your employer. And so if this is now going to count, right. they're going to count the people involved in the LLC. Then they're counting that towards their campaign contributions. And the limit is $5,000. So
that's enough. Enough.
Yeah. That is truly, you that's know what? Enough. I would be happy with just 5,000. That's enough for me.
Yeah. And then two of the other, important things, for the voter registration transfer, like if you move, you can take your voter registration with you, and pre-registration of 16 and 17-year-olds, which is like super huge. I mean, we talked on the voter turnout pod that we did about how hard it is to reach young people because it's hard and they're not a reliable voter. And so if we're getting them registered early, they know that they're registered. They know that there's elections coming up. You know, let's make that pool bigger.
I also just think like in this past midterm, there were so many active young people. Totally. For the first time, I felt like, you know, whether it's Parkland or the students who are doing the national walkouts, like there's all this youth engagement. And so let's reward that with like, it's one thing to vote and to get your candidate in, but it's not really a victory until you have a legislative change. That's real victory. So to reward those kids who were registering voters, even though they're not even voter age,
right.
like, let's make some laws that like benefit them.
Totally. Yeah, I agree. So there are items that were passed in the legislation, but that have to go to a referendum in the state, which is same day voter registration, which is exactly what it sounds like. You can register to vote. And like when you go to the polls, you're like, I'm new. Hi, hello. And I want to register. That has to go to a referendum because it's a constitutional change. So that has to go to the voters. The other one is no excuse absentee, which Piper mentioned, which is basically like you don't have to have an excuse. If you want to vote absentee, you should be able to vote absentee. It doesn't matter what your excuse is. That also has to go to the voters on a referendum.
Yeah.
There's other things that I feel like still have to be done, like automatic voter registration.
Yeah.
When you interact with any agency in the state. Totally. And also I want better ballot design. I feel like you guys remember voting in the midterm. Oh. It's like, there has to be a person there. It's like, don't forget to turn it over. And they put it in the scanner like this. I'm like, guys, this is a mess.
It's a mess.
Like, it's very confusing. Yeah. And it goes back to that consolidating the primary thing. It's like, if you confuse voters, they don't want to do it.
Yep.
And this is New York. I mean, like, you've got the most amazing design brains in the world. Go ask MoMA. Go ask the new school.
Absolutely.
Like,
get some graduate students on it.
Oh, my God. Ask a non-union actor. They will design anything. I swear to God. I mean, I talk about non-union, like, actor websites all the time because I'm always so impressed. But, like, geez Louise. I mean, I've seen, like, some postcards that have been designed by actors, you know? They can do the ballots. Artists are out there to help.
They will help you. Yeah.
Wait, can I say two more things?
Yes, of course you can. Go ahead.
I really want... Cuomo did this as an executive order, but it hasn't been made a law yet that he reinstated the voting rights of people on parole. I think it's like, my numbers by Rome, like 35,000 people in New York State. Uh-huh. And so he did it by executive order kind of because Nixon was pushing for it when they were running against each other.
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
It's not a law. And so I'd really like us to put it as a law so that the next governor doesn't just overturn it. Like you can see it with the president, like executive order is like pretty flimsy.
Yeah.
Like it works, but it's like not very. And then there's a thing that New York City does where we do public matching funds in campaigns. So are you into
that? Yes, totally.
Arden's
like,
face
oh
just
my God.
Lit up.
Like, I know where you're going and I am so on board.
I really think we can do it in the state. Even in New York, we do it 8-1, but they're talking about for the state doing it 6-1, but it just makes it so that more regular people can run. Like right now you have to be rich to run for office. kids. And that's not fair. And especially when you're trying to deal with the issues of normal people, it would be nice to have normal people who can run for office. Yeah. So I really want to do the public matching funds thing so that more people can run. And it doesn't put, I know somebody who ran for Congress, this is down in Texas, but she put her family into debt running for office because it's so expensive. And like, that's prohibitive.
Yeah. The guy that I worked for on the congressional race, he and his wife literally put up like their retirement.
That's bonkers.
Yeah.
That's too risky.
Yeah. Yeah.
Already want to serve and get paid like nothing to do this like thankless job and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Public matching is a big deal. I think the governor's office has like, there have been like little chirps about it. Mm-hmm. Like maybe they're going to support it. So yeah. I don't know. Have you heard anything about it?
No, I haven't heard it statewide. I know that the city, I think, increased. Either they did or they're talking about increasing the matching part of it, that they were going to like give people more money for the match.
I know, like I donate, you know, that public advocate election that's coming up February 26, I think. When I did a donation, they pat on the donation sheet, like, make sure you check this thing, like that you're a New York City resident so that the city will public match your funds. And I was like, oh, it's really happening.
It's happening. Yeah. Yeah. The public matching in the city is interesting because you have to like get so many from your home district that you're running in.
Mm.
And then you have to get you have to hit a dollar amount. So there's like two qualifiers that you have to hit.
And then when that happens, the city or your district will literally match the donation amount.
The city matches your donation amounts. Like there's a cap on it, but it's like a 6-to-1 match. It's really great.
Yes.
There's also a cap on how much you can spend, which I think would be another like, why are we spending millions of dollars on a governor's race?
We should not.
What you just said also, wouldn't it be nice if it could only be people in the district that could donate to a campaign?
Oh, I mean, like sweet dreams. That would be lovely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dreams.
I know. We'll get it all done.
We're working on it.
Yeah. Awesome. So that's New York State voter reform. I just was so happy that it passed, and exactly what you said, that it passed so quickly and that the governor signed it. It's going to be big for democracy in the state.
Awesome. So let's take a break and we'll see you on the flip side with the presidential veto.
I'm Emily Rems.
And I'm Callie Watts.
We're both editors of Bust Magazine in Brooklyn, New York.
And we're both hosts of Pop Tarts, Bust's feminist pop culture podcast.
Pop Tarts is a twice monthly podcast that celebrates women in pop culture. The first half of each episode is devoted to a cool guest or hot topic in entertainment. And in the second half, a segment called Whatcha Watchin', we dig into all the shows, movies, books, music, videos, and podcasts we've been enjoying. Plus, our guests are major. Callie, tell these fine people who we've talked to so far.
Well, we've interviewed Awkwafina, Liz Winstead, Jessica Williams, Julie Klausner, Phoebe Robinson, Rachel Dratch, Amber Tamblyn, Justine Bateman, Ricky Lake, Amanda Palmer, Janine Garofalo, and more.
And we have even more great guests coming up. Find us on iTunes at bust.com/poptarts or wherever you get your podcasts. Mwah. Mwah.
Awesome. So let's talk about the presidential veto.
Let's just shift gears.
hard right.
Hard
over here.
Right. There's a lot of fun. There's a lot of fun in the veto, which I'm inspired about.
Yeah. And actually, I thought we would talk about this. I was inspired by a tweet of yours because the one that you did that was like, so what happens if they pass like a funding bill and the president vetoes it? Like, can somebody tell me if like it has to be overridden? And I was like, oh my God, this is what we're talking about.
It's like, honey, we're here.
It was so great. And I love that like there was like a judge or a senator or somebody responded to you that was like,
Senator Schatz from Hawaii.
Yeah, yes.
Senator Schatz, he must be in his home district because he's still in the office. And I was like, wait, why? It was like late when I tweeted it out in California because I was in California working.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it's the Hawaiian senator who's still in his office back home. And he's like, actually, Piper. I was like, oh, thank you so much.
Yeah. It was great. I love that exchange. Like, those are the moments on Twitter where I'm like, this is good Twitter.
This is good Twitter. This is why Twitter was born. So our senators could tweet us back and be like, all right, this is what's,
this
happening,
is what's happening.
You know?
Yeah.
Let me answer your procedural question.
Exactly. Right. So, yeah. So why don't you want to take it away and tell us what a veto is and where it comes from?
100% would love to take this away. So, Piper, it's amazing that you have your constitution like on hand, because the first thing that I'm going to do is sort of so everybody else can gather their constitutions as well. They can read where this the idea of the presidential veto comes from, which is Article 1, Section 7. It reads, the Constitution reads, "Every bill which shall have passed the House of Representatives and the Senate shall, before it become a law, be presented to the President of the United States. If he approve, he shall sign it. But if not, he shall return it, with his objections to that house in which it shall have originated, who shall enter the objections at large on their journal and proceed to reconsider it." I mean, crystal clear.
Crystal clear.
Crystal clear.
Crystal clear. Also, it's automatically a man.
Can we please do he, she, they?
Oh, please. I know, right? I love reading the Constitution aloud on this podcast just so everybody can actually hear. Like, I'm just reading it word for word. That's how much of a clusterfuck this thing is, you know? It's not clear. So what this all means, a regular veto. A piece of legislation passes the House and the Senate, and it goes to the president's desk. The president has 10 days, excluding Sundays, because as we know, you know, bless the Lord. On my notes, I wrote, which, by the way, is some bullshit church and state nonsense. Because I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
That wasn't in the Constitution.
It really, you know, I think it was edited out, you know.
Franklin did not approve of that.
Yeah, they were like, guys, I don't think this is really on brand. we have a really clear, cohesive brand of confusing and clusterfuck. And I just think this bullshit might really detract from what we're trying to accomplish here. But yeah, so basically the president literally can just like chill on it for 10 days, excluding Sundays, under his eye. And then he can either say yes, like this is great and it becomes a law, or he can, you guessed it, say no, veto it, and then it must go back to the House and the Senate to be overrun, which we'll talk about in just a second. Another thing that he can do, because why have just one way to veto a law? You know, I mean, this is America, so let's make it just a little bit more confusing. He can do something called the pocket veto, which is super cute. So once again, he has 10 days, like I said, excluding Sundays, may the Lord open, to sign a bill. If he doesn't, and Congress adjourns during the 10 days, he doesn't sign it, and it doesn't become a law, and it dies.
And it dies.
And it dies.
It doesn't become law. It just dies. So then,
does that make sense?
So the thing with the adjournment, because I was like, there are a bunch of words in this thing that are like adjournment. It's just words.
There's so many words.
So many goddamn
words. I had to say anything about the Constitution, it's that the words are really overwhelming.
Just too many.
Wordy.
In amount.
She's wordy. She's a wordy girl. Like adjournment and session and recess. Like who knows what that means? Nobody. People who are staffers know what that means. Like adjournment. So like you have a session of Congress. At the end of the year, like when there's turnover in to a new Congress, like we just had into a newly elected Congress, or when like there's a holiday break, like that's when the adjournment happens. So sometimes there isn't like always an adjournment. Like this past session when we turned over, there really wasn't. Like it ended on January 3rd and it picked up on January 3rd. Like that was it. But there have been some where like the 114th Congress, just to give an example.
I remember it well.
Yes. We texted about it that day.
I was like, let me talk about this 114th Congress. Insane.
Adjournment.
But they ended on December 18th, and then the next session picked up on January 4th. So like those interim days would be like an adjournment.
And then a recess is?
And a recess is just like when they've like they're still in session, but they've decided to like take a break.
I thought recess is like the BS word for like you're going home to work in your home district.
Yeah.
So it's not like a recess like at school when you're on recess, you're allowed to like go like do whatever you want on the playground and like you don't have to do any work. But recess should really be called like home work period.
Yeah.
Something like recess, you're supposed to go home and do your work at your, you know, New Jersey office or wherever you're the congressman from, right?
Yeah, that's like, and I think that was the original idea of it. I think now people also use that time to like go campaign. you know what I mean?
I
like,
love it.
Like they do.
Like it's like we're still on the clock, but we're not.
We're not
working for our country. I mean, but you know, they're never really working for our country. So it's tough, you know, to differentiate. There's a couple of good eggs, but as the whole, it's like, what are we all doing there? You know, don't you ever just want to go into the Senate chamber and be like, what are we doing? What's everybody up to?
I want to know who's working and who's not.
Who? Give me the attendance sheet. Who's in class right now?
I think I had definitely identified when I saw Alyssa Milano in the back during the Kavanaugh hearings. I was like,
oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
She's working.
She's working.
She's in
she
class.
Is there. I feel connected to this process in a whole different way.
She's working.
She's working. Yeah.
Bless.
So,
but I don't understand, like, what the, can you guys explain to me the pocket veto thing? Like, what? Why would the Congress put up a bill when they know they're about to go into
adjournment,
recess or adjournment,
yeah,
knowing he can do this pocket veto thing?
I think sometimes they don't always know how fat, like a way for a president to veto something without taking like a firm stance on it.
Yeah.
So like if he doesn't want to say, I don't like that, or she doesn't want to say, I don't want to, like, I'm going to veto that bill, but he just kind of wants to let it die. They're going to take less political heat. And then to answer your question, because I realized I totally did not, I don't know. I mean, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me either. Like, why you would put something up unless you are also putting something up in the hopes of, like, we know he's not going to pass it, but we want to make a stand.
Right.
Like the way Republicans continue to do with the ACA. Like, they knew it was going to fail.
Yeah.
But they wanted to take a stand. They wanted it on record. Like, I could imagine that being a situation where that would happen.
But why would they put that? Why would they make that possible in the Constitution?
Oh, like, excellent question, Piper.
You know, because once again, what were the founders thinking? The title of my memoir will be that. It's like they weren't. You know, this, the Constitution, how this government was set up was very much either a first or second draft, which is why we have so many like loopholes and so many things that are like, this feels a little too complicated. I feel like if we just had like, you know, like a fourth like constitutional convention, we could have really ironed out some of these issues. I can't answer that question.
Maybe it was like a horse and buggy situation. Like they needed the time to travel.
That could be it.
And there's like some kind of weird thing we haven't thought of that had to do with like, it's going to take us 2 months.
Yeah,
to get here.
You know? And so it's like he need, you know, we just give him, like if he can't sign it, you know, on like,
we'll just do it again next session and it's no big deal.
Right.
Because that's what happens.
Got it.
Is that like,
that could literally be it because it took them 13 years to get, you know, to this Capitol and then another 13
to back to
the state, you know.
Because you can't override a pocket veto. You have to reintroduce the legislation. So,
Whoa. So
it just dies. It doesn't go anywhere. But then you could literally bring up the same exact thing when you're back in 2 weeks. And then the whole
thing. I know it's just so much work to bring it up again and go to committee and get it on the floor and the blah, da, da, da. So, like, I'm going to be, when this podcast airs, I'm going to be following your guys' Twitter feed to wait for like some smarty pants to be like, you know, the pocket veto.
Look, please, literally everybody call us and tell us why the pocket veto was included in the Constitution. I would prefer if one of the founding fathers reached out, but each their own. But that's
tweeted Senator Schatz.
I was going to say, he'll tweet us back.
Literally tell him to tweet us and be like, what's going on here? All right, you Mr. Know, veto expert.
Tell us what's happening.
Need your help, bro.
Yeah. So you can override a pocket veto. You can override a regular veto, which is what you were referring to in your tweet. And the bill goes back to the originating chamber of Congress. So if it started in the House, goes back to the House, goes to committee, goes to the Senate, and then it goes to the president again. You need 2/3 of each chamber to override it. So in the House, that would be 290 votes, and in the Senate, it would be 67. And just to give you a little sense of like what it would be like in our modern day, like partisan Congress, how hard that would be to like override a veto. The House has 235 Dems, 198 Republicans, so they would need like quite a few Republicans to like move over to their side to override a veto. And we've got 45 Dems and 53 Republicans. So again, a lot of Murkowskis and a lot of like Collins, those guys who would need to go over. And even like more, like it would be super difficult.
And to like put that in perspective, the government spending bill that the Senate tried to vote on that Trump ended up just doing anyways after they shot it down only got 60 or no, got less than 60. So got like 54, 57. Yeah, okay, great. So like we're still 10 away from an override. And even that was sort of, I feel like, a stretch from the Republican coming over into the Democrat side. So it's pretty difficult right now.
That's why I thought it was interesting that you guys were talking about this now, because I feel like now that we've, you know, we've gone, we've turned the government back on and we're going to govern for 3 weeks. My fear, everybody's fear, is that when the House and Senate pass the budget, if the president overrides it, there's not 67 senators that are going to go against his veto. So we're in a pretty precarious position here.
Yeah.
This 3 week government. Temporary running.
Whatever we're doing.
Whatever we're doing. You're absolutely correct. I mean, and like you sort of have to hope that like enough Republican senators took a lot of heat for the, you know, because the shutdown overwhelmingly has been like billed as a complete failure on Trump's end and the Republican leadership end, because nothing got accomplished on their agenda except that like thousands and thousands of federal workers did not receive pay. So I like, yeah, the only thing I can see happening is that the Republicans finally stand up to him, but.
But also I think like there's a period right now in this interim while they're negotiating what this budget is going to be and how to address security at the southern border without a wall.
Right.
And I think people can be calling their senators and members of Congress and putting the pressure on now, because right now is when they're figuring out the legislation. So you can be calling every day and saying, I really want you to fund the government. I really don't want a wall from, you know, from Gulf of Mexico to the Pacific. And just put that, let them know that you're really paying attention and you want this done, because that's the only way you're going to get these senators to feel the pressure.
Yeah, exactly.
They count the phone calls that come in every day.
They totally do. Yeah.
Always call your senators, because it does make a difference.
Yeah,
it genuinely does.
Call your reps.
Call your reps. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So let's talk about the line item veto, which existed. She existed for like 2 years.
She is an enigma.
She really is. But I feel like it's worth talking about because Trump has asked for it to come back.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. It's a red flag.
Yeah, he wants this line item veto back, which was like over. It was brief history. Clinton asked for it in the 95 State of the Union. In 96, Congress was like, all right, sure. And they did it. And then SCOTUS overruled it in 98. So he had it for 2 years.
Just say really quick what it is again, because like I'm not totally savvy.
No, awesome. So it gives the president the ability to reject parts of a bill instead of just vetoing the whole bill. So he can literally like take a pen or she and be like, I don't like this. This paragraph right here is not my jam. And you just scratch it out. And so that's why SCOTUS overruled it, because they were like, that's literally not how a bill becomes a law. Like, we've done the process. You don't get to then go in and be like, no.
Because people put things in like, well, I'll give you this if you give me that.
Right.
And so then if you know the president's like, don't worry, when it gets to my desk, I'll just cross that part out. It's like, that's not fair.
That's not fair. Yeah. And that's why they did it, because people were tired of like, presidents had wanted it long before Clinton, like Reagan wanted it for pork barrel spending. But because exactly this, like the in order to get it passed, they would put stuff in, and then the president wanted to be able to be like, but we're not going to do that, because then it doesn't matter what they pass. He can make any deal he wants and then just like sign it all away. Yeah.
No, not today, Satan.
Yeah. Mm-mm. No.
No, no.
We see you.
We see you. And like the Congressional Research Service like did a little they went back and were like, well, here's the ruling. This is why the SCOTUS ruled against the line item veto. And then they did some, like they proposed like four potential ways in which it could possibly come back. One of them is a constitutional amendment, which like, Good luck with that. Talk to the ERA folks.
We're still working the ERA.
We're literally.
Bro, let me do my ERA before all you people want to have. We've been working on the ERA a long time.
90 years.
Yeah. No. I know. So
Virginia.
I know. Ugh. Seriously. Virginia.
Virginia.
Your girl Virginia.
Virginia. We'll talk about Virginia later.
The other ways basically involve kind of calling it a line item veto, but like kind of skirting what it is. So instead of like, the president could never like scratch stuff out, but he could, there would be some wiggle room to like not appropriate funding to it, which was your concern with the New York voter stuff.
Governor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So like he could say, sure, I can't take out DACA, but like I can take out all of the funding that would enable DACA to happen.
Sneaky.
Do governors have line item veto?
Some of them do. Yeah. There's like 45-ish states that do. Yeah.
Tricky.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's tricky stuff. So that's the line item veto. She's not going to come back anytime soon form. But if Trump had his way, you know, I don't know what.
He would draw pictures. He would, you know, like, who knows what that bill would look like at the end of that. I mean, good Lord. He'd be like, I don't get these words either. So I'm just going to cross that out just for fun. I feel, you know, I feel attacked by a word like adjournment.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So I don't want to see the line item veto. I feel like it's already confusing and let's not make it worse.
Yeah.
Exactly. I'm officially anti-line item veto.
Excellent. Excellent. I love the stance. Yeah. So the next thing we kind of want to talk about is just like when the veto has popped up in history. So kind of like, you know, because we love going back in time and seeing just sort of the progression of some of these things, because it's very easy to just get stuck in the here and now and not understand like where it came from. We're going to go back in time. One of my favorite times when it was just 12 states and Virginia making up America. It's the late 1700s has, and George Washington is president. We have a nation. It's a first draft of a nation, but we've got one nonetheless. George Washington, bless his heart, was the first president and first veto. He vetoed a measure passed by Congress on how many representatives should be in the House of Representatives. So that was, you know, that was his first, like, no. Do it again, which I think is great. You know, I think if something deserves a second go, it's like how many people represent us.
Yeah, let's give that a second pass.
Let's do a redo real quick. Make sure we really know what we're doing here.
There's also something in there that's like it has to be one rep for every 30,000 people. And part of the reason he vetoed it was because they did the math wrong and it wasn't one for 30,000. And he was like, no.
He was like, gentlemen.
You guys went to the finest universities that our humble country can offer you.
Right. There's two of them and only white men can go to it. I don't understand how we can't do basic math. What's the thing called with the
abacus?
Your abacus out and let's do the numbers.
You get your math wrong, your bill should not get a pass.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Veto. Look, George Washington, she had standards, you know, she was like, look. If we're going to do this, we're going to do this correctly and with the proper math. And I love that. The first pocket veto, which we were talking about, was James Madison in the early 1800s. His pocket veto was this one, right? The uniform rule on naturalization, which it's very difficult to find what that means.
Literally, Lizzie looked, and then I looked for 45 minutes last night trying to find the bill that this man vetoed, and it's like nowhere.
He vetoed it.
And he was like, "And let's burn it. Let's burn it." But that was the Jennifer. Oh my God, that was the general nature of it. What's the Jennifer nature of it? Uniform rule on naturalization.
Yeah,
I assume I actually can't. I don't know what James Madison would have been up to in that time period. When it came to naturalization.
I just like that, like, in the old days when they vetoed it, there wasn't even a trace left.
No, they were like, let's burn it.
Yeah, well, it was on parchment, you know. Perfect. It probably disintegrated, you know, when it came in contact with sunlight. So it's like, yeah, I mean, we literally probably have lost it. Although if you have seen this bill and you're listening, call us and let us know what Jamesy was doing.
If it's in a file, in a box, in the Library of Congress, we would like to see it. Thank you very much.
I formally request to be led into the Library of Congress. Can you imagine?
I think you can go, but also we could just.
Of course, you can go.
Yeah,
you can go.
I can go.
Yeah, anybody can go to the Library
of Congress. No, but I want to like go into the Library of Congress. You know what I mean?
There's certain things you need like special permission, and you have to write like why you need to go, and then you have to wear those gloves because you're not allowed to touch the old paper with your regular hands.
Look, I will put in a request to see this bill if it exists.
I think we need a trip to D.C. I think that's what's happening.
Oh, my God. I feel like they'll get that letter and be like, what? Out of all of them, this one?
Congress is a woman, too. Like, it would be so fun to go meet her.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
We're going.
Pack up the materials.
Listeners, next time you hear from us, we'll be in D.C.
Oh, I love it. Awesome. Cool. So then the most vetoes, we'll just talk about these hot messes for a sec.
first. Look.
They were. FDR, 635 vetoes. I mean, now he was elected to four terms, served three and change. That's a lot of vetoes.
That's a lot of vetoes. That's but again, vetoes. There's the Great Depression, you know, which was sad. And then there was World War II, which was also a big bummer. There was a lot going on.
Yeah.
And he was doing like trying to pull us out of the Great Depression with all of the, you know, Social Security and the New Deal. So I'm not surprised. He was very active with Congress. Like he would like bust in and be like, write this bill for me. And they'd be like, no, what? Why are you here?
Yeah.
Go home.
Trying to save a nation.
Well, come on. I know he was.
He's trying to do good.
I know. So it's not surprising to me that he has the most vetoes. It is surprising that it is that many vetoes.
Yes, that it is that many vetoes. He also like sometimes like to play political games. And so one of the vetoes was that he vetoed a bill that would have increased federal payments to World War I soldiers and their dependents.
Mm.
And it was like part of, it was like part of like a political gaming process. Then he also vetoed a bill that it was called the Revenue Act of 1943. And it would have, he like asked lawmakers for $10.5 billion in funding in taxes to like pay for war and stuff. A war is expensive. And they were like, no, we'll give you, I think it was like $2 million or something. And so they passed that bill and he vetoed that because he was like, no, bitches, I said I need money. Like, you have to give me money for war.
Like Rihanna.
Yeah. He, unlike the people in George Washington time, did the math, you know?
Yeah, he was like, this was is
like, let me $10 billion is the cost. Number. Yeah. Let me break down the cost of bomb.
It would depend, too, like, if the Congress is predominantly your party or not, right?
Right.
Like,
yeah,
if you're all the same party, like New York State right now, like, this thing is crack-a-lacking. But if
exactly.
you're going to fight, there's going to be a lot of veto.
Totally.
Which is a great transition
that is a great
to the second most vetoes that a president has given out. This one's going to surprise you because it surprised me and I'm tickled by it.
Oh,
Grover Cleveland was the second most vetoes. I know. Take it in. Grover Cleveland. And this is just in his first term because if people know, Grover Cleveland had two terms, but he's the only president who was like his second term was like after another president. So he was not elected, you know,
consecutively.
So his first term, 414 vetoes over the course of 4 years. And now, so what you were talking about, Piper, after the Civil War happened, we had a string of Republican presidents because the Republican Party was the winning party of the Civil War. Party of Lincoln. And so the Democrats did not look great after it. Grover Cleveland was the first like break in that like slew of Republican president. Grover Cleveland was a Democrat. He was a war hero. So he was actually like wildly popular when he was elected, but he was dealing with an entirely Republican Congress.
Oh, interesting.
So it's like the only way Grover could like do really anything was to say no 414 times. And then in his second term, which was, you know, a breath later, he had an additional 150 vetoes. Like, I'm like, Grover,
your name is Grover.
Your name is, first of all, your name is, I veto that. Let me talk about a line item. You love Grover? I do not love Grover.
I'm telling you, first of all, as you're saying this history of Grover Cleveland and his vetoes, I'm like, okay, this should be an HBO series.
Yes. Where is Ken Burns?
There's so much drama.
Like
Boardwalk Empire, like we could do not a documentary. Like, I mean, I think it should be like a show.
Yes.
Like Grover.
Piper, you need to get on
Grover.
That.
All right. So everybody look out for the HBO series Grover. That's going to be coming to you. There's going to be so much nudity. It's insane.
Nudity and vetoes.
Nudity and vetoes. That's the undertitle.
Yeah. So sweet, sweet baby Grover was just saying no left and right. Yeah. And like there was no wars happening during his presidency. It was genuinely really because nobody, like, it was just Grover. It was partisan. They couldn't get stuff done. It's also shocking that, like, he had the opportunity to say no 414 times. I mean, I think we're used to, in modern day, there being, like, a bill, a session. You know, it's like there's not, like, the output of, like, legislation is so much less than it used to be. And I think that's, like, that's also hard for me to even fathom that Congress, like, went to work every day and, like, kept putting up bills to constantly, like, do something with the country, you know? That's, like, a bill a day. That's 440.
That's a lot.
That's so many. That's so
but
many.
You can see it in New York State. I mean, I'm sorry to keep going back to New York.
No, bless New York.
Like, they, you know, they did reproductive rights. Yeah. They did DACA. They did voting rights. They, they are on a tear because all of a sudden they all got their ducks in a row. Yeah, they're full head. So it just shows you, like, when you really get it together,
you can get stuff done. It also just shows that, like, I met with some of the IDC folks and I was like, they would always say, like, we have no extra power. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, yes, you did. And all of this right here that you're like the new legislature is passing proves it. You guys had so much power.
Totally.
It
puts them to shame.
To shame. In the recent history of vetoing, it's interesting because we were talking about before we came on that, like, it seems to be like a correlation between how many vetoes there are with the breakdown of bipartisanship. So, like, Reagan had 78 vetoes, Papa Bush had 44, Clinton had 37, Baby Bush and Obama had 12, and Trump has 0, which just, like, harkens back to the conversation we were having about, like, how much they're not passing bills for presidents to veto because the partisan divide is so great. They're just like, he doesn't have to veto anything, Trump, because, like, nothing's going through.
And, like, McConnell can sort of, like, lead block for him, in a football team. Like,
totally.
Like, what he was saying with the budget. He's like, I'm not going to put it up for a vote if the president's not going to say yes. Like, McConnell can take all that heat for the president. It's kind of messed up.
It's really messed up.
No, not a fan of Mitch McConnell. I don't think Mitch McConnell is a fan of Mitch McConnell. I don't think
he likes himself very much.
You're exactly right in that it's like, this whole idea that we're not going to pass anything if the president is just going to veto it, that is a very recent thing. Like, this was not even around with Obama because, like, there's, like, this thing of, like, if you're the party, you're like, well, let's hope we have the votes so that it passes. But, like, the idea that they wouldn't even, like, try to do a congressional override, which is what the Democrats were, like, shouting for to the Republican Party during this shutdown, was, like, if he vetoes it, we can override it. We literally have that power to do that. And then it doesn't matter what the president says. The government opens.
I think that's why you hear people on the news, like when you're seeing congressmen and senators on the news, they're all saying, we are a co-equal branch of government. We are a co-equal. You hear it over and over now on the news. Mm-hmm. And I think they're sort of saying it at Mitch McConnell, who's holding back legislation because the president won't sign it, as though they work for the president.
Right. And they do not.
In fact, they're co-equal. Right.
Yeah.
If anybody's confused, everybody in the government works for us.
Thank you for clarifying.
They do. They work for us.
I agree.
Trump works for us. Mitch McConnell works for me, bitches. I mean, you know, I'm not from Kentucky or wherever he's from. But, you know, all of our federal congressional members work for the people, and we are the people. It literally starts we the people, not we Mitch McConnell, you know?
Piper, this has been so fantastic. I cannot thank
you
enough.
It's so fun to talk with you guys.
I know. We're always like, black out, you know, and I'm just like.
This is so much fun.
So fun. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, it was great.
Do you have anything you want to plug? Anything coming up?
I do have a new show coming out on Netflix, actually.
Yes. Is it called Grover?
It's called Grover. Yes. It's about the president with the second most vetoes in history. Yes. No, he's a little sexier than Grover. It's with Idris Elba.
Oh, yes. Heard of him. Heard of him.
It's called Turn Up Charlie, and it's about DJs. It's like the international DJ scene.
Oh, nice. Awesome. Oh, that's so cool.
Do you know when that's dropping?
March 16th.
Guys, March 16th. You, me, Piper, Arden, Idris, we're all going to be there on the Netflix.
On the Netflix. We're going to watch
it. Yeah, you guys already have the headphones. Like, you can do this DJ thing, no problem.
Done.
Yeah,
we're here.
We're going to be in season two. You guys just wait.
Perfect.
Awesome.
Thank you guys again so much for having me.
Thank you, Piper.
Have a great day.
Have a good day. Bye.
Bye.